Resurrection, I want to talk about for the next 40 minutes or so. And you know, the interesting thing is that unlike any other religion, Christianity stands or falls on history. And that often doesn't, people don't often notice that, but somebody once remarked, you know, that you could take the founder of any other religion out of history and that religion could still stand. So if Buddha had never been born, somebody else could have brought the system of teaching known as Buddhism. You know, Nick could have taught the Fourfold Path and the Eight Noble Truths and all those kind of things, and it would still be Buddhism, but it would just be called Johnsonism, and there'd be little statues of Nick Johnson and Green Jay all across Asia.
It looks like Buddha.
Well, I'm glad you said that. So, okay, moving rapidly on, and interestingly, the same goes for Muhammad. Actually, if you took Muhammad out of history, somebody else could have taught the systems of teachings that became the Quran. It wouldn't need to be Muhammad, and that goes for every other founder of every other religion until you come to Christianity. Because the more you look at it, you realise that Christianity is not a set of teachings brought by Jesus or a set of morals brought by Jesus, but is Jesus. In fact, somebody once said, if you take Christ out of Christian, all you're left with are the letters I, A, and N, and Ian can't really help you. I did that really bad joke at a church a few weeks ago, and a gentleman came up to me at the end and said, I need to have a word with you. And I said, what's up? He said, my name is Ian. Well, I was horribly offended. I'm a dentist, I can't help people. So there we go. But yeah, if Jesus of Nazareth didn't live and preach, teach, die and rise from the dead sometime in the early 30s of the first century, then Christianity falls entirely. And I always say that's really helpful, actually, because it means if you're a sceptic, I say to my sceptical friends, and you want to investigate Christianity, or you're a Christian and you want to commend Christianity, we can tell people that the resurrection is a great place to start. Because if the resurrection really happened, it vindicates all of Jesus' claims about himself. He makes some pretty outrageous claims. He claimed to be equal to God. Maybe he was a liar. Maybe he was a lunatic. Well, if he rose from the dead, that kind of demonstrates he was who he claimed to be. Because I think people who rise from the dead make remarkably good witnesses, actually. And so that fascinates me. What fascinates me too as well, of course, is that all of this is a historical claim. The claim that Jesus was arrested, the claim that he was tried, executed, the claim that he rose from the dead 3 days later are historical claims, and we can investigate the claims of history. And I say to my sceptical friends, if they turn out to be true, we need to do something about them, and if it turns out not to be true, it's foolish nonsense. We either have to bow the knee, or we have to walk away. And the story of the resurrection really forces that choice upon us. So with those opening words in mind, let's refresh our memory with what we're dealing with here. So I'm going to read to you from Luke chapter 24. If you have a Bible with you, feel free to open it or open it on your phone or whatever. But we will have the text on the screen, at least while I read it to you. Luke chapter 24, famous passage from the scriptures. So Luke 24, Luke tells us, on the first day of the week, very early in the morning, the women took the spices they had prepared and they went to the tomb. They found the stone rolled away from the tomb, but when they entered, they did not find the body of the Lord Jesus. While they were wondering about this, suddenly two men in clothes that gleamed like lightning stood beside them. In fright, the women bowed down with their faces to the ground, but the men said to them, "Why do you look for the living among the dead? He is not here. He has risen. Remember how he told you, while he was still with you in Galilee, the Son of Man must be delivered over to the hands of sinners, be crucified, and on the third day be raised again." Then they remembered his words. When they came back from the tomb, they told all these things to the 11 and to the others. It was Mary Magdalene, Joanna, Mary the mother of James, and the others with them who told this to the apostles. But they did not believe the women, because their words seemed to them like nonsense. Peter, however, got up, ran to the tomb. Bending over, he saw the strips of linen lying by themselves, and he went away, wondering to himself what had happened. While they were still talking about this, Jesus himself stood among them, and he said to them, "Peace be with you." They were startled and frightened, thinking they had seen a ghost. He said to them, "Why are you troubled, and why do doubts arise in your minds? Look at my hands and my feet. It is I myself. Touch me and see. A ghost does not have flesh and bones, as you see that I have." When he had said this, he showed them his hands and his feet. And whilst they still did not believe it because of joy and amazement, he asked them, "Do you have anything here to eat?" They gave him a piece of broiled fish, and he took it and he ate it in their presence. Jesus said to them, "This is what I told you while I was still with you. Everything must be fulfilled that is written about me in the law of Moses, the prophets, and the Psalms." And they opened their minds so they could understand the scriptures. And he told them, "This is what is written. The Messiah will suffer and rise from the dead on the third day. And a repentance for the forgiveness of sins will be preached in his name to all nations, beginning at Jerusalem. You are witnesses of these things. I'm going to send you what my Father has promised. But stay in the city until you have been clothed with power from on high." So the question I'm really interested in is whether we can make a historical case for the resurrection of Jesus. Could we just purely, as historians, make a case for the resurrection? Or is this something we can only believe by faith? And I say to my sceptical friends, actually, the interesting thing is I think we can. Because there are five basic facts about the death and resurrection of Jesus that are agreed upon by the majority of historians, be they Christian or Jewish or secular or agnostic. Five facts we need to explain, and I want to suggest that the bodily resurrection of Jesus is the best explanation for the five of them. And here they are. Fact number one, that Jesus was crucified and killed. Fact two, his tomb was discovered empty. Fact number three, his disciples had experiences in which the risen Jesus appeared to them. Fact four, doubters and skeptics encountered the risen Jesus and were converted. And fact five, the early church was founded on a belief in Jesus' resurrection. And interestingly, by way of sort of background to this talk, I did a version of this talk at one of the universities the other week, and it was this talk was the final kind of cherry on top of Ashwant's story, who you heard in the early video, when we were talking through the things you had to believe to be a Christian. And one of my colleagues said to him, "Do you believe that Jesus died and rose from the dead?" His words were, "Well, after Andy's presentation at lunchtime, only a fool would consider otherwise," which is very gratifying. So hopefully, I'm sure you all do believe as Christians in the resurrection, but hopefully by the end of this talk, you'll have some material you can share with your friends when you talk about the resurrection to say, look, there are good reasons why Christians believe things. So these five facts of history, let's explore each of them in a little more detail. So fact number one, Jesus was killed by crucifixion. That Jesus was tortured and crucified and killed by the Roman authorities sometime around AD 33 is, in the words of John Dominic Crossan, a sceptical historian, one of the best attested facts of ancient history. He says that Jesus was crucified is as sure as anything historical can be. We are on absolute historical bedrock. He's a sceptic. So why are scholars like him so convinced? Well, primarily there was no reason for the first Christians to invent the crucifixion. It was embarrassing. It was humiliating. In fact, Paul in 1 Corinthians talks about it being a stumbling block to Jews and foolishness to Gentiles. Not least because most of the first Christians were Jewish. They believed that Jesus was the Messiah, and the Messiah was supposed to overthrow the Romans, not get killed by them. And a crucified Messiah was incredibly embarrassing. In fact, you can read, in the sort of a couple of hundred years after the crucifixion, pagan Roman critics of Christianity, people like Celsus, who was a Roman poet who mocked Christians, he mocked them for believing in a crucified God. He thought it was a ridiculous idea. And so the idea that somebody would make up the crucifixion is highly, highly, highly unlikely. It's also important to notice that the crucifixion is mentioned actually in non-Christian historians, non-Christian ancient sources, writers such as the Jewish historian Josephus or the Roman historian Tacitus. So Tacitus, very well regarded, very important Roman historian who we depend on knowing a lot about the ancient Roman world, he writes this about Jesus. And he's writing this in the very early 2nd century. Tacitus, the Roman historian, says, "Nero, the Roman emperor, fastened the guilt and inflicted the most exquisite tortures on a class of people hated for their abominations, called Christians by the populace. Christus, Christ, from whom the name had its origin, suffered the extreme penalty during the reign of Tiberius at the hands of one of our procurators, Pontius Pilate." Of course, historians get very excited because we have not merely Jesus, we have his capital punishment, the extreme penalty, and we have the right Roman Emperor, Tiberius, and of course Pontius Pilate there mentioned as well. So a number of things from the Gospels corroborated there by the Roman historian Tacitus. We also have the Jewish historian Josephus, who goes a bit further. The Jewish historian Josephus, writing about the same time, writes this. He says, about this same time, there lived Jesus, a wise man, for he was a performer of marvellous feats and a teacher of such men who received the truth with pleasure. He attracted many Jews and many Greeks. He was the Christ. When Pilate sentenced him to die on the cross, having been urged to do so by the noblest of our citizens, but those who loved him at the first did not give up their affection for him, and the tribe of Christians who are named after him have not disappeared to this day. And most historians take this very seriously. Some people do think the phrase "he was the Christ" as it was inserted by a later Christian scribe copying Josephus. It doesn't sound the kind of thing a Jewish historian would say, but the rest of it is pretty authentic material. And again, so we have a lot of information here, the crucifixion and the fact that his followers claim that he'd risen from the dead, and so on and so forth. So historians are confident and comfortable that Jesus was crucified. But how can we be sure that he died on the cross? Maybe if we were going to be hyper-skeptical this morning, we might say, well, maybe he was crucified, but maybe he just swooned on the cross, and maybe he came round afterwards in the cool of the tomb, and with medical treatments and a few smelling salts wafted under his nose, maybe he popped up and came back and wandered around and convinced people he'd risen from the dead. How can we be sure that he really died? Well, first thing is, the Romans were very efficient at killing people. In fact, there was a saying in the ancient world, if the Romans wanted you dead, best thing you could do was start digging your own grave. It would just save the time. Crucifixion is a way of killing people they had perfected. And in fact, crucifixion was so brutal that we even have historical accounts of people who'd been crucified, had been up there on the cross for a few hours, taken down afterwards because perhaps it had been discovered they were innocent, and it was too late. They died anyway. Their wounds were so horrific. But interestingly, three or four decades ago now, a group of medics writing in the Journal of the American Medical Association, very well-regarded American medical journal, decided they would do a historical investigation. They looked at the accounts of the crucifixion in the Gospels and tried to analyse them using modern medical knowledge to ascertain whether or not Jesus died and, of course, what ultimately killed him. And they conclude their analysis, 20-page, quite detailed medical analysis, with this conclusion. Three high-ranking medics say interpretations based on the assumption that Jesus did not die on the cross appear to be at odds with modern medical knowledge. So we can be sure of fact number one, that Jesus died by crucifixion. Fact number two, Jesus' tomb was discovered empty. According to multiple early independent sources containing eyewitness testimony, Jesus' tomb was found empty early on the Sunday morning by a group of his women followers. And the empty tomb subsequently formed the key part of the preaching of the early church. If you read Peter's first sermon on the day of Pentecost in Acts chapter 2, Peter talks about the empty tomb as part of his preaching. And most scholars, most historians, think the empty tomb, we are on very, very, very reliable ground historically. Why is that? Well, firstly, is what they call the Jerusalem factor. Jesus was crucified and buried in Jerusalem. And there in Jerusalem, his followers begin preaching that he's died and risen from the dead. And most historians say that is hard to imagine if just around the corner from where Peter is preaching on the day of Pentecost about the resurrection, there is a tomb with his body in it. All the authorities would have to do is say, hang on a moment, you say your leader has been risen from the dead. No, he hasn't. There's his corpse rotting and stinking in that cave right there. Very, very difficult to imagine how Christianity got going in the very city where the tomb was if it wasn't empty. Now, what's interesting, of course, when we look at what the authorities do, that's not what they do. They don't produce a body. In fact, they do precisely the opposite. Preserved in the New Testament writings are what the authorities, the religious authorities, are saying. It's fascinating. In Matthew chapter 28, we have this amazing, intriguing little story of the chief priest devising a plan and paying off the Roman authorities, the guards at the tomb, to say, look, his disciples came to us during the night and stole him away while we were asleep. In other words, they were to put around the story that the disciples had stolen the body. And historians say this is very interesting. because everyone's agreed on the same thing, right? Everyone's agreed that the tomb is empty. The disagreement is as to why. And the disciple who stole the body may be the worst excuse in history, but it still points to an empty tomb. A bit like if back in your university days, you'd gone to one of your professors and said, I'm sorry I can't hand my essay in at the end of term, the goldfish ate my homework. That might be the world's worst excuse, but you are at least admitting you have no homework to hand in. And the authorities here clearly stuck with the fact they have an empty tomb that they have to explain away. But there's another interesting fact about the empty tomb that gets historians very intrigued, and it's the fact that his tomb was discovered empty by his women followers. So it goes without saying that if you were the early church making these stories up, and this is nothing more than legend and invention, why, oh why, oh why, would you have women as the witnesses? Because in the ancient world, which was incredibly sexist society, women and children and people who were not high-class men were basically considered to be second-class witnesses, second-class citizens. In fact, the testimony of a woman in a court of law was in many ways considered to be at least half that of a man. So if you were the early church making these stories up, why, oh why, would you not have Peter or James or John, high-ranking, Jewish, you know, good, reliable male witnesses? We were even told in Luke 24, where we read this morning, that the disciples didn't believe the women at first. They thought they were a bunch of frightened girls, basically, and it wasn't until they went and saw things for themselves. And historians say the only conceivable reason that one can imagine why the women are here in these Easter stories is because that's what really happened. And yes, it was embarrassing in the culture, and yes, it would be much better if it had been the male the apostles and so forth, but it wasn't. Everybody knew that it was Mary and Martha and Mary and Salome and so forth, and there the women are in the stories and the Gospels. So, Jesus was crucified, killed by crucifixion, fact one. Fact number two, his tomb was discovered empty. Fact number three, his disciples had experiences in which the risen Jesus appeared to them. You know, an empty tomb on its own would probably not have generated the Easter faith for the disciples. Imagine you were the disciples back there in the first century, and you come along, you discover the tomb empty, and that's it. Nothing else happens. What are you going to think? Probably you're going to think, I don't know, grave robbery has happened. That was not uncommon in the ancient world. That's the kind of explanation you would go for. And maybe an empty tomb on its own would have generated lots of theorizing by the disciples as to what had happened to the body of Jesus. But it would not generate the kind of Easter stories that we have. For that, we need something else. For that, we need the resurrection appearances. And thus, our third historical fact is that Jesus' followers not merely claimed that he'd risen bodily from the tomb, but they claimed that Jesus had appeared to them on numerous occasions. And the New Testament records lots of those appearances. And when you look at them in the New Testament, you notice something quite interesting. First thing is, they're very diverse. Jesus appears to men and to women. He appears to believers and skeptics, to single individuals and to groups ranging in size from 2 to 500. He appears indoors and outdoors, in Judea and Galilee, in the countryside and in the country. He appears close up and at a distance. He appears in the morning and the evening. He appears on a hill, by a lake, on a road. He appears sitting and standing and walking. And that huge diversity makes any suggestion that these were hallucinations very unlikely. Hallucinations not merely tend to happen to a single person. In fact, we psychologists don't know actually of any such thing as group hallucinations. If skeptics ever say group hallucination, you can say, can you give me an example of one? Because psychologists who study these things would love to study them. We don't actually have any examples of group hallucination. But they also tend to happen to people who are highly strung, imaginative or nervous, and in particular places. So if all of the disciples, for example, had been going singly along to the tomb of Jesus and weeping outside the tomb, and had individually had experiences of Jesus sitting on the stone by the tomb saying, hey, I'm really risen from the dead, you might say, oh, hallucinations, there in the graveyard. But they are so diverse, and particularly that they happen to groups, means that most historians would rule out hallucination. But there's another problem, of course, for our skeptical friends. If you rule out the resurrection appearances, if you deny the resurrection appearances, you are left with the mystery of what turns a bunch of frightened men and women hiding out from the authorities, terrified that just what has happened to their leader is going to happen to them, afraid that they'll be killed and executed, what turns them into people willing to risk their lives for the message of the resurrection? Listen to a Jewish scholar, not a Christian, this is a Jewish scholar, Jewish historian, Pinchas Lapide, making this very point in one of the books he's written on Jesus. He wrote, if the disciples were totally disappointed and on the verge of desperate flight because of the very real reason of the crucifixion, it took another very real reason in order to transform them from a band of disheartened and dejected Jews into the most self-confident missionary society in world history. If we deny the resurrection appearances, his question stands. How do we explain it? Well, there are a few other fascinating features too. All the resurrection appearances in the New Testament have a physical component to them. Jesus talks to people, touches people, eats meals with people. The story of Thomas, actually, in John chapter 20 is a very good example. If you remember that story there with the so-called doubting Thomas, it shows not merely did Jesus's his close disciples not believe stories just because they heard them. I mean, Thomas is a huge rationalist, really. Well, you lot have all claimed you've seen him. I haven't. I won't believe until I can see for myself. And then, of course, he also draws the obvious conclusion that first, his first thought is, when he sees Jesus, it's a ghost. Because people don't rise from the dead. So he goes for literally the only explanation he can conceivably think of. And only when he gets to physically interact with Jesus, he finally is willing to believe. And then it's worth noting something else as well. The resurrection appearances end. In Acts chapter 1 verse 3, Luke tells us that the resurrection appearances went on for a period of about 40 days until Jesus ascended into heaven, and then short of one appearance to Paul in Acts chapter 9, they end. And of course, if the resurrection appearances were just made-up stories, or hallucinations or visions, why did they not carry on for centuries? Why did they not carry on into the early church? Why do we not find people in the 200s, 300s, 400s, 500s saying that the resurrected Jesus appeared to me, I'm like one of the apostles? They don't. They're confined to this very short window of time. Huge problem if you're a skeptic and you wish to dismiss the historical reality of what we're dealing with here. So three facts down, two to go, and then we'll wrap this up and have time for some Q&A. So the crucifixion of Jesus, we're in touch with history. The empty tomb, resurrection appearances, and our penultimate fact then is that doubters and skeptics were converted. And two in particular, two doubters and skeptics are particularly fascinating. James, the brother of Jesus, and Paul, persecutor of the early church. Let's start with James. James is fascinating, and interesting that one of the leading sort of skeptics of the Bible and Christianity today is a former Christian, now an agnostic, called Bart Ehrman. Not so well known over here, but certainly in the States, very famous, and if you were to Google him, you'd find his story all over the place. He's published books that sell millions, attacking his former faith. But a friend of mine in Canada a few years ago had the privilege of doing a debate with Bart on the reliability of the scriptures. And one of my friends took Bart out to dinner for this debate. And during the debate, my friend Greg, who's a bit of a monkey, sort of thought he'd have a bit of fun with Bart. So over the dinner, looks at him and says, Bart, I understand you used to be a Christian, right? And Bart says, yes, I used to be a very, very committed Christian. Wonderful, my friend said. Tell me, just out of interest, do you think you could switch places tonight? Do you think you could debate for Christianity rather than against it based on, you know, what you used to believe? And Bart has a very overinflated sense of his own academic abilities. So he was like, oh gosh, absolutely, I could definitely do that. And so my friend Greg pushed it further. He went, well, what about the resurrection in particular? Because that's the key part of Christian faith. Do you think you could argue for the resurrection to a university audience like tonight? And Bart's like, oh, yes, absolutely, I could. Very much, I think I could still do that. Then my friend Greg asked one further question. He said, well, Bart, what would be the centerpiece of your argument? If you were going to argue for the resurrection and role-play being a Christian, what would you make the centre of your argument? Very interesting what he went for. He looked at my friend Greg and he said, well, I would make the centrepiece of my argument for the resurrection the conversion of James, the brother of Jesus. He said, because to this day, that actually still genuinely gives me trouble. Why does James give someone like Bart Ehrman trouble? Well, not many people are aware, of course, that Jesus had brothers, but the Gospels report that he had at least four half-brothers, whose names we know, James, Judas, Joseph, and Simon, and the Jewish historian Josephus refers to James. So we're on very good historical ground when it comes to Jesus' brother, James. Now, we also know that James was not a follower of Jesus during his lifetime. In fact, the Gospels actually record that none of Jesus' brothers believed in him, and actually even considered him mad Mark chapter 3 and John chapter 7, you've got two little accounts where the brothers of Jesus come and try and take Jesus sort of quietly away. And the sort of subtext, I think, is very clearly, this is our lunatic brother who's going around making all kinds of ridiculous claims. Let's just take him quietly back to the family home. And that's not a fact the first Christians are likely to have made up. Very embarrassing to be a first century Jewish religious teacher whose own family doubted you. So again, it looks like we're in touch with history. So what happens next? Well, if you read 1 Corinthians 15, we have this list of all the people that Jesus appeared to in the resurrection appearances, and James appears on that list. Paul explicitly tells us that James is one of the people that Jesus appeared to. And whatever happened in that encounter, it clearly had a huge transformative effect, because James doesn't merely convert, but ends up becoming a leader in the Jerusalem church, and actually ends up leading the church, one of the first Christian churches there in Jerusalem, and more than that, ends up dying for his beliefs, according to the first century Jewish historian Josephus. Josephus tells us about the martyrdom of James sometime in the 50s AD. And so he's gone from being a skeptic to being a martyr. And I think Bart Ehrman's trouble with him was, you know your own family. You know, if your brother goes around claiming to be the Son of God and then gets himself crucified by the authorities and then turns up 3 days later, brothers, family, that's a much closer relationship. And the fact that James was so powerfully convinced by what happened that he was willing to follow his brother's example and lay down his life is very, very powerful. Quite a turnaround. Another conversion that's equally hard to explain if you're a skeptic is the Apostle Paul, who of course we first encounter as a persecutor of the early church, going around murderously breathing out threats against the church, holding the cloaks of the people who stoned Stephen to death and so on and so forth. Pretty nasty piece of work. And then he dramatically turns overnight from persecutor to preacher when he encounters the risen Jesus. And he too is willing to face arrest, torture, and execution. Church historians think that Paul was probably killed there in Rome sometime in the early 60s. And as one historian remarked, liars make bad martyrs. If you know that the story you're telling is false, and someone says to you, okay, deny the story or I will kill you, most human beings at that point go, yeah, I've made it up. You know, I know I've been saying for the last 2 weeks that Nick Johnson levitated on stage on Saturday the 1st of December, but if he threatened to kill me for that story, okay, he didn't, he just bounced rather high. Nobody squeaks about the resurrection of Jesus, none of the apostles, and most of them were killed for their faith. Nobody turns around and goes, yeah, you know what, we made it all up, we exaggerated. All of them go to the grave saying, no, we believe that he rose from the dead. Very, very impressive. Yes, David.
Why is it Apostle Paul got a King James Bible on his desk?
Oh, I forget whose picture this is. Is this Caravaggio? I forget who this is. I love putting classical bits of art up, but no, it is interesting. There's a whole lecture you can do on how, you know, on how Christian or how Jesus is represented in art and how people represent them. Yes, it could be the King James. I mean, I don't know. Maybe it's the.
I'm familiar with his highlighting as well, but that's a good one.
Yes. You know what, Nick, I like to think, because Nick and I, you may know this from last night, all of you, is that we were, Nick and I were at theological college together, and one of the hardest exams we had to write was on Pauline theology in year 3. I like to think that Paul here is doing a theology exam on his own work. Because quite frankly, Romans in places is dense enough, that would be lovely justice, actually. But there we go. Moving rapidly on, and thank you for that, David. So four facts down, one to go. Fact one, Jesus was killed by crucifixion. Fact two, tomb was found empty. Fact three, resurrection appearances. Fact four, conversion of skeptics. And last, but by no means least, the early church was founded on belief in Jesus' bodily resurrection. And you see, the thing you have to explain, if our skeptical friends wish to deny the resurrection, you have to explain what started the early church, particularly what caused it to break away from Judaism. See, most of the first Christians were Jewish, and they had a perfectly good religion. A religion that Jews were proud of. It functioned really well for thousands of years. And what caused the first Christians to break away from Judaism, to define themselves by proclaiming that Jesus was God's Son, the Messiah, the world's true King, risen, crucified and risen from the dead? You know, it's worth noting too at this point that most Jews in the first century believed in resurrection, unless you were a Sadducee. Most Jews believed in resurrection, but you believe that resurrection was what happened at the end of history. And as good first century Jews, Jesus' followers should have believed that when he was crucified, what you should have done is taken him down from the cross, put him in there in the tomb, waited for his flesh to decay, and then you take the bones, fold them up, put them in a bone box called ossuary. And archaeologists have discovered thousands of these bone boxes from the time period, and they'd have put Jesus' bones there on the shelf in the tomb, and he'd have waited the resurrection at the end of time. No Jew in the first century believed in one man being risen from the dead in the middle of history. That is a unique belief to the early church, but the belief that he had been raised from the dead is what began the early church, and it led the first Christians to lay down their life for their beliefs. It caused them to restructure their entire worldview, and it caused them to start a movement that would change the world. And consistently, whenever you ask the first Christians, either in the New Testament or in other early writings they have bequeathed to us why they did these things, the answer you get is the same all the time, because Jesus rose from the dead. So these are the five facts that need explaining. That Jesus was crucified and killed, his tomb was found empty, his disciples had experiences in which the risen Jesus appeared to them, doubters and skeptics saw the risen Jesus and were converted, and the early church founded on a belief in the resurrection. And how do we explain them? Well, for the skeptic, it's very, very, very hard, actually. William Lane Craig, who's one of the Christian world's most well-known philosophers, told us a lovely story of debating an atheist at the University of California who'd written a PhD on the resurrection. And unable to deny any of those facts, this skeptic had invented the idea that Jesus had an identical twin brother, and that twin brother, no one knew about that twin brother, and the twin brother hid himself away 33 years, and suddenly after the crucifixion, he sneaks into the tomb, removes the body, hides it, and then appears and pretends to be Jesus and convinces everybody. And you look at it, that kind of idea, and you go, so desperate and ad hoc is that kind of theory that it shows you just how powerful is the evidence for the resurrection, if that's the lengths you have to go to as a skeptic. But at the end of the day, history can't prove that the resurrection happened. You can never prove to somebody 100%. But you can do what historians do all the time. We can look at the facts, we can look at the hypotheses to explain those facts, and we can ask what explanation best explains the facts in front of us. What explanation best explains these five facts? When it comes to the strange Easter stories generated by the discovery of the empty tomb, the appearances of Jesus, the bodily, physical resurrection of Jesus, I just say to my skeptical friends, it explains the data we have far better than the alternative. And of course, if Jesus rose from the dead, if his claims are true, that sheds light on who God is, sheds light on who we are, what the problem is, what the solution is, because if Jesus truly is God's son, if he truly died for the wrongdoing, the mess, the brokenness, the sin in each of our lives, that has huge implications. And unless if Jesus rose from the dead, that's not a neutral truth claim. It's one that demands action. But the fact that it's not neutral, that it has some implications, I think is often what causes many people to run away from it. You see, despite the overwhelming evidence, it can still be hard for some of our sceptical friends to face up to the resurrection, because it comes down not just to facts and history, but to worldview. For someone who's been raised, you know, here in secular the UK, who's been told since they were, you know, this high that miracles don't happen, that science can explain everything, that God isn't there, that we're alone in the universe, you know, the resurrection would be a hard story to take seriously. I often hear people say, well, dead men don't rise, to which I always like to respond, I completely agree with you. That's not what the stories are saying. The first Christians weren't running around saying, hey, everyone comes back from the dead. You know, dying is just like a trip to the chemist's down the street corner. Rather, the New Testament is saying this is a one-of-a-kind occurrence and the sign that God's new world, God's creation, is the new creation is beginning to dawn. You know, what fascinates me is that people have always argued and disputed about the resurrection. That's not new, largely because the resurrection is profoundly disturbing. In the book of Acts, the Jewish religious leaders hated the resurrection because it threatened their power. It revealed that Jesus was the Messiah. The Roman authorities, people like Nero, persecuting the first Christians, they hated the resurrection because it challenged the idea that Caesar was Lord. And right down to the present day, tyrants and bullies and elites and the intellectually arrogant have hated the resurrection because it's challenging and it's upsetting. So you can't fit the resurrection into the kind of postmodern, naturalistic, secular, sceptical worldview. It just won't fit into the jigsaw. But if the Easter story is true, though, it's the foundation stone of a whole new worldview. Foundation stone on which you can build or on which you can stumble. And I remember giving, just to think by way of conclusion, I remember giving a version of this talk last year at the University of Aberdeen, and that was a largely sceptical audience. And very interesting, gave a talk, a lively Q&A, and at the end of the lunchtime event, a young man came up to talk to me, and he asked if I had a few minutes, and I said I did, and we sat and talked together. He said, Andy, before I ask my question or make my point, he said, I need to give you my background. He said, I was raised in a Christian home, but threw all that off, rejected it all by my teens. I thought it was all in the rubbish, and became an atheist, very convinced atheist, and then came here to university and haven't thought about religion since. Because I'm only here today because I was bribed by the offer of free sandwiches. Same as on the video, actually. That I want to go. Free food is a great way to get people to evangelistic events. And he said, your talk has profoundly disturbed me. He said, because I never realised there was evidence that Christianity might be true. He said, I always thought people believe because they believe because they believe because they believed. Why did no one tell me this? Why didn't my parents, why did my church leaders when I was in the youth group never tell me there were reasons why these things were true? I think I've made a horrible mistake. And I think I've got to reconsider some things. What shall I do? What a great question. So I just looked at him and I said, well, great news is we've all made horrible mistakes. That's why Jesus came in the first place. So, you know, join the club. But I said, what you can do is over there, there's a table for somewhere that the students are signing up people for a thing called Alpha. I'd get yourself on that pretty quickly and now go revisit things because there's incredible evidence, not just that Jesus rose from the grave, but for the whole of the story. I'm sorry that you were never given it then, but why don't you correct that now? And once he went off and joined the Alpha course. The resurrection is a wonderful thing to talk about, that, friends. The evidence is overwhelming. Don't feel there's something you have to hide under a rock. Go talk to our friends about it, and when they ask, share some of these reasons, get the slides that we'll send around. It's an easy presentation to learn and see how the Lord uses it.